Hi, Tony. I'm Alex Craner. I'm a author, a former hedge fund manager, a geopolitical and economic analyst, and proud author of a banned book called The Grand Deception, book about Bill Browder, the Magnitsky Act, and anti-Russian sanctions. I'm very happy to join you today.
Maybe we could say something about the current state of sanctions. I remember reading this week that the United States is rather perplexed because they've run out of sanctions. They found it very difficult to find any more sanctions, economic ones, to put on Russia or Russians. And they've noticed that actually the Russian economy seems to be doing fine. So maybe your book was almost the start of this process that now seems to have kind of hit the a brick wall.
Well, I have to say, I'm not entirely convinced that the current Trump administration is driving for sanctions to hurt Russia. In 2022, the collective West already imposed practically nuclear sanctions over on Russia, the most harsh set of sanctions ever imposed upon any country ever in history. And that didn't work. I believe that what Trump is doing now is he's trying to use the general environment of hostility towards Russia to do what he wants to do. And what he wants to do is he wants to impose tariffs. He wants to create a protected market for American manufacturers. And rather than calling it tariffs, rather than calling it what it is, he's calling it sanctions against Russia, against whoever wants to trade with Russia, against whoever likes Russia, against whoever likes Venezuela. He's using the hot button issues of the day to justify implementing measures that he wants to implement. So I don't think this is, hurting Russia or Russia's trading partners is his primary objective. I think his primary objective is doing what he announced that he wants to do, and that is introduce tariffs and create a protected market.
Yeah, okay. So can it bring back manufacturing to the United States? Because it seems to me, actually, the Asian countries like China, etc., have already beaten the Americans at their own capitalist game.
Well, yeah, that's exactly the thing. They've already beaten them. So, the United States played a part in it. They transferred all the manufacturing to China and other East Asian and South American countries. And so now Trump wants to reverse that process. Can he bring back manufacturing to the United States? Of course he can. He already is. There's already a lot of European manufacturing powerhouses that are transferring their operations to the United States, among other places. And so that is already happening. The effects will be seen with a certain time delay. We won't see them immediately, but in a few years we'll see that American manufacturing is picking up. The question is whether American manufacturing will be able to compete with Chinese manufacturing. That might take a lot more time. But it's not, it's entirely possible. It just won't happen overnight. It might take, 10, 20 years or so.
Okay, so one of the things that everybody seems to be investing in at the moment in the West is artificial intelligence. And it's two real questions I've got for you here. One is this a bubble? Is it going to burst? But before that, I wonder if you could just say what you think it's sold as the future, that this is going to be basically looking after humanity. Put your money into this because it's going to show great returns into the future. So, what's it actually all about? And is it a bubble or not?
I think there's no question that it's a bubble. And I think that the Western financial system depends on blowing bubbles. And so when one thing runs out, they have to invent a different thing. One second, please. They have to invent something else. And so it seems to me that AI is just the latest one of those things. And the investment has been extremely heavy. And we're at a point where, NVIDIA is, in a roundabout way, giving $100 million credit to ChatGPT to buy their wares. That would be like a shopkeeper giving credit to his clients in order to boost his own sales. One day when the clients come back and they say, like, sorry, mate, we can't pay you, the whole thing collapses. And this is exactly what they're doing. So there's no question that it will burst. And then maybe they will find another bubble. If you recall, some 25 years ago, we had the dot-com bubble, and then that burst. And then we had the housing bubble, and then that burst. And then ever since the Wall Street has been looking for the next bubble to create. And we do have like almost an everything bubble now, but they've been talking about, oh, next thing is going to be the 3D printing, and nothing happened. And then the next thing is going to be the driverless cars. That's going to be huge. I don't know if you remember that, just like maybe 10 years ago, everybody was talking about driverless cars. You couldn't turn on CNBC or Bloomberg TV without them talking about driverless cars. And so now it's AI. AI is a very impressive technology, but it's limited. It's I think that the promise of AI has been overblown to make it seem that it's a replacement for natural intelligence. It's not. It's what we're talking about are large language models. And large language models have become very, very good at spitting out what's out there, meaning they can replicate the world's knowledge base in an interactive way. So you ask a question and you get very impressive sounding answers. The problem is that AI cannot think for itself. It can only conjure up forms of knowledge that are already there. And it's very, very good at doing that. But if what's there is junk, what's going to come out is junk. So for anyone who's played with AI enough, that becomes very apparent. AI doesn't know stuff. AI just reflects the knowledge that's already there. So, that's it's a cool technology. It's impressive. It can be helpful, but I think it's overblown both in terms of its potential and in terms of its scope. It's not, it will not replace humans. It will only
Well, I mean,
replace.
it does seem, Alex, that that is the role of AI. For example, when with politicians, maybe AI can write their speeches for them. They can just read them out from an auto cue. Maybe when you phone up to get help from an ambulance, fire brigade, or washing machine repairman, you will have a conversation with AI, which will make decisions about what's wrong with your washing machine. So in politics, maybe even in the press, AI can be writing newspaper articles. So it seems to me like it's a kind of a human replacement technology.
Well, if you talk about repairing washing machines, that's actually very helpful because that's very cool. You can, instead of depending on a repairman, you can ask for instructions how to repair a washing machine, and you'll get those instructions, and you'll be able to do it yourself. When it comes to writing speeches for politicians, I think that's more difficult because, in my experience, there's something sterile about AI. It
Yeah, but
can
there's
draft.
something sterile about politics in Britain.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're right. You're right about that too. You're right about that too. So maybe it won't ruin things in Britain and in the West in general. But I think that in all the places where you want human touch, AI will fall short. You know what I mean? Like for example, take university students who use AI to write their term papers. And then, because every student has a little bit of their own individuality and character and style, And then when they turn in term papers that seem like they were all written by the same person, the professor can tell. And then obviously they understand that the students just copy-pasted AI-generated text. So that's not good. And I think that, when it comes to writing, for example, AI can produce very impressive sounding music. Except again, like when you hear it the first time, you think like, wow, this is nice. This is cool sounding. But when you've heard 10 songs and they all kind of sound the same and there's nothing really there, well then, I don't think it's going to have, I don't think it's going to be able to replace humans entirely at all.
Well, no, maybe just 99%. Anyway, listen, you spent a lot of time investing. You've seen which things bring returns and which don't, and you've spent a lot of time looking at markets, which point to pull out of a market in order to save your investors' money. If you are now looking at whereabouts to invest, if you can, assuming you have money. I mean, that's fine, but we're now in a situation, for example, our Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, she's doing everything she can to balance the budget, whether that's right or wrong. But one of the things she's trying to do is stop people saving. So are people like you ultimately going to be out of a job?
Well, probably not any day soon, but eventually I should say I hope so, because the only way my job makes any sense is because we are living under a fraudulent monetary system, and if we lived under an honest monetary system, you wouldn't need to spend money investing. You would just generate value and you would be able to generate savings, and those savings would be worth something. Rather than them evaporating and then you having to go speculate in the markets to generate returns in order to prevent your savings losing purchasing power because the money is being constantly diluted away.
So could Trump, do you think, make a real difference in the States, a much bigger difference if he were to do some sort of monetary reform? And if so, what?
It seems to me that he's already trying to do so or planning to do so. That's part of his mission. I think that Trump, while it seems to me that his administration is on a mission, I can't tell whether they have an actual strategy, or whether they're just shooting off the hips and deciding the next move based on on what just happened today. And so certain reforms are already taking shape. But you see, the reform of a monetary system will probably require crashing the current one. So I think that implementing some kind of a new monetary system will have to come only after a substantial collapse of the current US dollar system. And of course, this is not something that you can advertise. You cannot come to your electorate and say, like, guess what? We're going to crash the dollar system and you all are going to lose all your savings. So that kind of has to happen almost as a natural disaster, that the administration can say, like, well, it wasn't us. This was just going to happen anyway, and we have to
Yeah,
deal
well,
with
what bothers me
contingencies.
is if something like that does happen, you can almost guarantee that the financial wizards have predicted it and they're going to have their own new system ready to implement, which is going to even more enslave people in some sort of, debt trap. But anyway, we were talking a little bit before we started recording, actually, about acceleration. I know this as accelerationism, which is this kind of Nietzschean political philosophy. But you see acceleration quite a lot, don't you, in markets, etc.
Yes, that's true. I think that, we are at a period of history where the crisis, which is caused by an overhang of unpayable debts, is getting increasingly more grave and increasingly more acute. And so we see policymakers responding to it. With increasingly harsh medicine. And so we see, events almost cascading on a daily basis, things that you might see, some big event happen once a month, once a year, once every couple of years. It seems that they're almost happening on a daily basis. And I think this is because we are, of course, this is not news to anybody. We are in a system that's unsustainable, and so something is going to break very soon. But I think that the ruling class, the people who are on top of the food chain, want to delay it. They want to give themselves as much maneuvering space to manage the crisis as possible. And so we're having, events just following one after another, and each one seems to be more dramatic than the previous one. And we constantly feel a certain anxiety of something going badly wrong. They're introducing such radical measures like digital IDs, central bank digital currencies. They are doing their darndest to get us into a World War III against Russia. They're starting wars in the Middle East. They're starting wars in South America, in the Caribbean, and on and on and on and on. And so what it tells us is that we're probably somewhere along the way of a major unraveling of the crisis, which historically I think would have taken shape in a major war. When things get really, really hot, the ruling class usually cries barbarians at the gate, and they get all the fighting age males to go to war in a major bloodletting, and that then takes the pressure off of them. It takes the it's the people who might actually stage a revolution at home who end up being sacrificed in a foreign war. But this time around, it seems that it's not succeeding. This war between Ukraine and Russia didn't, at least for the time being, didn't escalate to World War III. And it seems to me that the Russians are aware of the traps, and they're avoiding giving Western powers any pretext to escalate the war to a World War III level conflict. So the crisis is kind of being consumed at home. And I think that in addition to collapse of the monetary systems, high inflation, maybe hyperinflations, collapse of the bond markets, we're also going to see social uprisings, possibly revolutions and civil wars. And I think that as these unravelings are coming closer, we're feeling there's a perception that events are accelerating, and in a way they probably are.
No war with Russia. That sounds good. That's a nice prediction. Is it so surprising that Rachel Reeves, our Chancellor, would look at trying to eliminate people, tax people's wealth, tax people's savings? I mean, there's a lot of people are worried that this is going to disincentivize people from actually even working. So that there seems to be something very strange going on with the British economy. It's almost like it's imploding and they're running out of ideas.
Well, it's not really strange. This has happened many, many times before. Maybe just not to Great Britain in the last 5 decades. But this is a completely predictable outcome of the monetary system that we have in place, which is completely fraudulent. And it regularly produces these types of crises because what happens is that the level of debt always grows faster than the level of wealth that the society can produce. So over time, you have more and more and more debt in the society, and you have less and less wealth relative to all that debt. And then, it puts pressure on governments to enter into the economy as a participant, and they are obliged to they're obliged to interfere in the economic game more and more. And then They have to, you know, it's not enough for them to tax and spend. They have to actually spend more than what their tax receipts are. And that means that you have government deficits, the budget deficits growing faster than the tax receipts. And so at some point,
if you had a phone call from Rachel Rees from the Treasury saying, we realize that it's hopeless, what can we do, Alex? What would you say?
I would say change the monetary system, you know, introduce an honest monetary system, because this one isn't. Of course, they will not listen to me. They wouldn't listen to me. And if Rachel Reeves wanted to implement an honest monetary system, she would be eliminated very quickly, like Liz Truss was. Liz Truss was a little bit onto the problem. You know, I'm not sure whether she understood it with full clarity, but she at least got the idea right in broad brush strokes. And she wanted to move in the right direction. She was immediately eliminated. So I think that short of a radical political change, which might, you know, take shape as a revolution, if a change through the legitimate structures of society aren't possible, you would have to then completely reform the economic and monetary system. Short of that, we're always going to go through these crises. I mean, you know, when in 1825, when Bank of England got the monopoly on creating money, the, you know, they became the only issuer of the British pound. Over the next roughly 100 years, I think that Great Britain spent at least half that time in financial crises, bankruptcy, recessions, or depressions. And you had a major, massive, huge 20-year depression, 23-year depression between, I think, 1873 and 1896. And then you had, you know, panics in 1907. And I can't name all the years now off the top of my head, but it's just been one thing after another. And we are witnesses in our own times that we're practically chronically in some form of a crisis or another. It's the effect of this monetary system, because the society on the whole is very productive. You know, we have all these insane technologies. We can, you know, produce food enough to feed the whole society with maybe 2% of the labor force in our societies. We make machines that render everything easier. We have the internet that renders our access to information super easy, fast, and accurate. We have all kinds of things, and it's so strange that we're always teetering on a verge of crisis, or we're in the midst of one. And then the answer is always more war. And so, you know, in the century, 110 years after Bank of England became the sole issuer of British currency, Britain fought 17 or 18 officially declared wars against France. Because back then, the British hated France almost as much as they hate Russia today. But people don't remember. You know, they think that this conflict with Russia is something special and different and unique. But before, it was Spain, then it was France, then it was the Dutch, then it was the Danish, then it was the Germans. Now it's the Russian. And so, you know, the population is constantly being dragged through financial crisis, economic crisis, misery, plunder by the government, wars abroad. It's all the effect of the monetary system that we have in place. Of course, you know, the powers that be are making sure that people can never work that out, you know, by constantly feeding us false information, misdirection, nonsense. What they teach us in school about economics and money is completely wrong. I studied economics. I took it deadly serious. You know, I was one of those big geeks who graduated magna cum laude. It took me years to figure out that the whole thing was a lie. But, you know, we can see the proof in the pudding. I mean, we shouldn't live like this, constantly at war, constantly in crisis, constantly ridden by anxiety. Are we going to have enough to eat? Will we be able to pay the rent? It shouldn't have to be that way, and it doesn't. You know, we could actually enjoy life on this planet. This is our birthright. We're
Well,
extremely
you're
productive.
right. It does seem to me as if we're either heading towards some sort of major crisis, revolution, complete collapse of government trust, or else someone needs to get the Bank of England to start issuing money to poorer people so they can start to increase their living standards, to start spending money to help the economy. I mean, it really does look as if, to me, as if this is some sort of it's almost like a prison, a trap, which is getting the walls are coming closer and closer in, and they're coming in slowly, so we can't even see them. Anyway, look, Alex, if people are interested in finding and following your stuff online, where can they find you on social media, etc.?
Well, I have two publications on Substack. One of them is a daily market newsletter for investors and traders. It is called iSystem Trend Following. The other is my personal Substack called Alex Craner's Substack. And I'm also active on X, the former Twitter. My handle is at Naked Hedgy.
Are you investing in this AI bubble or
Oh, no, not at all.
not? Okay. Glad to hear it. Okay. Thanks very much for joining us.
Take care, Tony. Good to be with
Cheers.
you. Bye bye.